Joseph Chilton Pierce is the author of The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, which he actually wrote 25 years before it was published. And although that was 1971, it still holds sway in today's consciousness movement. Joseph had a keen awareness of our collective consciousness in those days and to today. This interview I'm replaying is from 2012 regarding his book, The Heart-Mind Matrix. A small dimension of freedom and creativity still exists for us, seated in the prefrontal cortex of our brain, but unnoticed in the ever-present pull toward the fear and survival lower brain. A great observation by a great man whose life is spent clearly communicating consciousness, partly in his bid to give children a chance in this world, but mostly because this is who he is. Joseph Chilton Pierce wrote The Crack in the Cosmic Egg about 50 years ago, educated many parents with his writing The Magical Child, and most recently The Heart-Mind Matrix, an absolute must-read. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Joseph, thank you so much for your time today. I very much appreciate it. Let's start with, as you say in your book, evolution calls all points of constraint and limitation. How do you see the evolutionary formation of our brain supporting that?
Well, I started off this little new book of mine, which I didn't call The Heart-Mind Matrix. I didn't like that title at all. The original little book was called Strange Loops, as you know. And it was the book Robert Sardella was just as much a part of it as anybody could be. And he's a hero of mine. He has the School of Spiritual Psychology down in Benson, North Carolina. Does wonderful work. We got off on the business of strange loops, and the thing about strange loops is that one of the principal parts of strange loops is that there is no creator without creation. There is no creation without creator. They give rise to each other, and I was thinking of the problem that our contemporary world faces with what we call material science. I have drawn the conclusion that the material scientist, you know, the guys looking through their test tubes and building all of their stuff, has been one of the great disasters for mankind. I think science has been literally a great enemy of our human being. And to say that you think science has been destructive and so on and so forth in this day and time is a no-no, because science has become our new religion. And anybody that wants to back up some foolishness they're talking about, all they have to do is say, well, the scientists say, and everybody shuts up, because, of course, then they've got the God on their side, practically. So one of the protests I have been making is in having made science, I'm thinking of science in its contemporary term of the what builds all these atom bombs and all the rest of the good things of life. That has been really one of the great disasters of our history. And the problem we face it because of that, and the great freedom that there is in discovering, in the process of discovering who we really are. We get into this business of the strange loops. I had no real way of getting into the issue of strange loops until I thought of back in 1950. Arthur Eddington, one of our great scientists, who had spoken of how the human has discovered so much in so short a period of time, and of the awesomeness of what we have discovered. And I got off on this, and he was talking about, and then Eddington said, it seems that man's mind is a mirror of the universe, for it to contain all this information. And, of course, I picked up on that with great delight. I said, yes, man's mind is a mirror of a universe which mirrors man's mind. And this leaves people puzzled. But this is the case. This is the prime strange loop of our life. Our mind mirrors a universe which mirrors our mind. And that means that what we have to reap as we sow, the world we find ourselves in is one we have created, not been cursed with,
right,
and
yes.
So on. And actually, the discovery that man's mind is a mirror of a universe which mirrors our mind is the greatest freedom that you can imagine. And in our ordinary daily life, it's a tremendous freedom to discover that the world out there and the world in here give rise to each other. And I have seized on that with thousands, practically, of examples that prove it in every possible way. And I think of my own discoveries pretty early, back in my teens, that eliminating all fear in myself opened up a whole raft of new possibilities, that fear was the great enemy. And I discovered that I could find myself in a certain space, and by dropping all fear and throwing myself off a cliff without a parachute, because I knew something had to happen if we do that. And discovering that in my own life, fire did not have to burn me. Gravity didn't have to hold me under very certain special situations in which one throws themselves away, so to speak.
Yes, well, you do mention in your latest book that science is born out of the culture of fear.
Oh, yes.
And so that's certainly a big clue as to why you feel like it's not necessarily been the good God that many people seem to cling to it to be.
Well, I certainly would emphasize this all over again. I think of my own history, which is this idea has really governed nearly everything that I've ever done or wanted to do, is this notion that if we can enter into each next event without fear, then all sorts, it's like a carte blanche. No, that's not the term. An empty slate. We can write what we want on it.
Yes, and so I see through what you've been saying in the way I initially asked about evolution calling all points of constraint and limitation, I think the fear is what sort of contains a box or makes that constraint and limitation, and it's the evolutionary call to let go of all of that and just be, in our proceeding, just be within that.
Rightly so. In this new book, I start off with talking about evolution and creation giving rise to each other. That and really, the more you think about it, the more you'll see this the way it has to be. That without evolution, there could be no creation of worlds or anything else. Without creation, there could be no evolution. And I defined evolution as the immediate response to any limitation or constraint. The minute we hit a point of evolution or constraint, the minute we hit any point of constraint and so on, the evolutionary process can lead us beyond it if we hold to it.
Right, if we answer the call. Well, your book is just so chock full of amazing information that's floating around us, and unless someone reads your book, they're not going to know about a lot of this information that really is so supportive of what life really is, which is, you know, community. And we are only here in relation to everything else and vice versa. And you start out with speaking about mitochondria. And of course, that's where energy is created and takes place, and how mitochondria cannot survive on their own because they only have half of DNA. So it needs to connect to a full DNA.
Uh-huh. Oh, that was a lot of fun to get into. But the whole issue is the way in which we are just terribly caught up in our self-imposed limitation. The human being is absolutely unlimited in capacity. We have an infinite capacity within us, but for creation of every conceivable sort. But we also have, it seems, an infinite self-imposed limitation. Right. I've been claiming all along that the only thing that keeps us from opening up and being who we truly are is a self-imposed limitation, not imposed from out there. People will say, oh, but what about people dropping atom bombs on you? Give all these what-if circumstances. But none of this is the case of the human being's capacity for creation. And blocked only by self-imposed limitation.
Right. I read this sentence the other day that was, what if there were no hypothetical questions?
Well, that's an interesting thing, yeah.
Well, one thing that you bring up, I mean, the mitochondria story is so fascinating. Who knew? And you talk about how the mitochondria are the tail of the sperm that sends a sperm on its way, and when it gets where it needs to, the tail is no longer there, and it's not like it drops off. It just isn't there anymore. So you bring up the most interesting idea of effect preceding cause, and I know this is something the Buddhists would call dependent rising, and if we could get this one under our belts as well, it would create another opening.
Oh, that current straitjacket, which mechanical or whatever you want to call it, science has put us, is just tremendous. It's the worst imposed limitation that we've ever faced. And boy, I did seize on the Buddhists. They're one of the few belief systems that just open up entirely. It's a completely open-ended proposition. Most other religions are, to my way of thinking, just disasters. But I once said, by golly, if you want to get down to brass tacks with this figure of Jesus, he was a Buddhist. And that, of course, one of the things I've gotten really interested in recently was Rudolf Steiner. I think he's one of the great geniuses of the past many centuries. I think of Eckhart in the 14th, 15th century, and Rudolf Steiner being really quite similar in just giving us a view of who we are that's breathtaking, and yet rejected because our culture is simply built on fear and how to protect ourselves against it.
Yes.
So the whole cultural process has been our great enemy. But Susan Langer is the one who said one of our greatest fears is the collapse into chaos should our ideation fail us. And our ideation is our enculturation, how our culture has formed our mind practically from birth. And once that forms, then we're scared to death of it, of not having it, even though it's crippling us.
Yes. Well, in your book, you speak about this from many different directions and bring them all together very well. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that cultural counterfeiting as you're speaking now. And then also, you write that we're functioning as a reptilian hybrid, and what master are we actually serving? And if you could speak a little bit about the brain and its formation and how it helped us to get into this situation, and then we'll speak more about the heart.
Well, I've often defended Darwin. I know he's been kind of, they figure he's kind of passé now, but Darwin was a great genius, and he turned out two works. One was The Origin of Species. Now, that's the pure evolutionary kind of thing. We start off with this little amoeba or something, and it evolves and evolves and evolves, and it finally all the way up until we get these species covering the whole Earth. And so The Origin of Species was what Darwin's first book is about. Everybody seized on it immediately because it had to do with the survival of the fittest. And everybody likes that. So, okay, we're going to get tougher than our neighbor. We'll build bigger bombs than our another neighbor, and we don't have to worry. The survival of the fittest, that has really brought about the whole of modern life that we know of, is that terrible error about what this show is all about. But people ignore the fact that Darwin, boy, he really caught it from everybody, even as a lot of people really grabbed up on that idea of survival of the fittest. Like the British were just beginning to do their big colonial push to have the British flag over every island in the world, and the capitalistic system was just getting started in Europe, and when Darwin's book came out, boy, they seized on it. Gave the idea of capitalism was, you know, survival of the fittest.
Sure,
and that was the way to go. And if it didn't, you deserved being poor and neglected. But they neglected then to look at Darwin's second book. He caught heck from everybody. Went back and settled in his little garden. Brilliant, brilliant man. Did nothing but study biology all of his life, knew everything happening on Earth about biology. And he finally came out with his second great book, which stated that survival of the fittest and all that kind of thing could bring about the origin of different species, but it could not explain the human being. And he said the human being can only be explained through the discovery or the opening into the world of love and altruism, and that love and altruism gave rise to the human being, not survival of the fittest. That was the first part of it, just all the different kinds of species on Earth. But out of that, what determines the rise of the human? Love and altruism.
Right. I think the lion was created from survival of the fittest, not the human.
Well, yeah. The thing of it is, if the minute you look at that, not only does it make an awful lot of sense that love and altruism are not just the true marks of the human, but that which brought the human being about. And the minute you get into that, you're in a deeply spiritual aspect. And I think it's the we really have a kind of a built-in guard against anything that can be called spiritual. But spiritual human is what everything is about. I was just looking at this again this morning, book that Man's Mind is a Mirror of the Universe that mirrors man's mind. And all of the aspects of being a spiritual human, and how in this day and time, this is really denied. It's denied on every hand.
What I was brought to think of while you were telling me about the second work of Darwin when he was older and he was hanging out in his garden and sort of getting more together, in a sense, it does go along with how the elders in these societies of late are not really looked at. They're not you, not that you would use an elder, but if you listen to what they're saying at this stage in the game after they've written something like Origin of the Species, then that would be where you'd want to research and glom onto and really dive into. And it's like with Louis Pasteur, he had this whole thing about how the germs are from the outside of the body and you need to vaccinate and homogenize and pasteurize your milk, and all of this grew out of it. And yet I've heard stories of him on his deathbed where he just said, oh no, I had it wrong. It's the inside environment of the body that's creating all of this. So anyway, it's just interesting to see where people want to focus and where we're going to give our attention to. And as you bring up, you speak about how our heart is the intelligence and the mind is the intellect. And as the intellect gets sharper and sharper, our crisis gets deeper and deeper. And speak about that a little bit, if you can, please.
Well, the whole issue there is I pulled out a lot of recent work from the time of Margulis and Sagan on the ultra-microscopic world. Once we had that electron microscope, they began to find what really is going on in the human being. And their pictures of the mitochondria and all the rest of it change our whole attitude toward ourselves dramatically, if we'll allow it. But there again, we are subject on every hand to a culture of fear, and fear dictates just about everything. My contention is we're born into this world for a relationship. Life itself is nothing but relationship. And the issue of our relationship with life, with ourselves, with our heart, everything hinges on that. The heart, one of the neat things that ever happened for me was over in India. I spent about 10 years in that ashram of Muktananda's. The first thing he ever said to me was, there's only one heart. He said, the heart beating in my chest and the one beating in your chest are the same thing. And he went on, he said, billions of little egos appear in the head, but only one heart. And then we go ahead and we find that the heart is the source of all intelligence. Intelligence is the real key to all life, whereas the head and the brain give rise to intellect. And that's great. That's exactly what life intended, was the heart, which is intelligence itself. We could say the heart is God itself. The heart is everything. As an intelligent, functioning, beautifully organized, marvelous thing, but our head is subject to culture, and we're afraid of isolation from our culture more than anything else. And that gets me into one other thing I want to touch on right quick, that in Rudolf Steiner and Eckhart and a whole bunch of others, you find all the idea that one should prepare for death, the preparation for death. That is, Rudolf Steiner said, we spend all of our time trying to avoid death and fearing death above all things, whereas we should find out everything we can about death and prepare for it. It's we spent half the energy in trying to escape death, in exploring death and preparing for it, then it changes everything. And my own experience, I just want to throw out right quick, particularly since my brother died about 2 years ago, which unhinged me considerably. I was the last of eight in my family, and my brother, finally, when he died, I was the only one left in my family, and my family had always been kind of a backdrop against which I saw my life given shape and meaning and so on and so forth. And that was all of a sudden just gone, and I found that when I got to thinking about Steiner saying we shouldn't avoid death, we should prepare for it. Not that we should become immersed in death and morbid or anything like that, except that being prepared for it, then you would never again be afraid of it.
Well, all right. You've got plenty of time to pick up a copy of The Heart-Mind Matrix by Joseph Chilton Pierce and read it before we're back next Sunday with the conclusion of our chat. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for our weekly guest notices, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.